This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. As you may have seen on the little brochures that get sent out from Labrie or on our website, the rather generic title of tonight's lecture and of what will ultimately be a series of lectures is an Islam primer. Now, a primer, by definition, is an elementary introduction, a kind of a rudimentary treatment of a given topic or discipline. And in this light, both tonight's lecture and the lectures that I hope will follow will focus on introducing the central themes or basic aspects of Islam. Now, the chief goals of the lecture series is really threefold. First, to provide a basic understanding of Islam. That's been one of the most neglected things in Islamic-Christian interaction over the years. We've not sat down to understand each other. So our first goal will be to understand Islam. The second, to assist in promoting an informed or meaningful response to Islamic claims. And thirdly, really to help Christians in particular befriend and feel comfortable talking to Muslims who they might meet in their workplace, in their home, in their university, wherever. Now, so that we can all know what to expect from this series, I want to say two things up front. I want to say that I'm not even close to being an Islamic scholar, and my mispronunciation of Arabic terms will give that away straight away. And the claim that my goal is not to be comprehensive, not to be detailed, but rather to be fair, to give a straightforward introduction of what is basic and central and essential to Islam. So really the way to think of this series is as a partial survey. The second thing I want to say is that although this series will be kind of more in the popular style, yet I want always to be fair to the Islamic position. So throughout these lectures, I will be using primarily Islamic documents and Islamic sources. The Quran, the prophetic traditions like the Sirah, the Hadith, and then looking at some of the very early biographies of the Prophet Muhammad, and of course acknowledged Islamic scholars. So they were my primary materials and resources that I'll be drawing from. And also for the sake of charity, my sincere desire is to stray away and to keep away from any kind of controversial or questionable commentary that may not be called for. Well, it's enough of the preliminaries. Now we're all on board. Let's begin our journey. Tonight we begin our Islam primer with a look at Muhammad, Islam's holy prophet. And the course that we will chart tonight is really rather clear. My conviction is that the only way to really understand Islam is to understand the prophet, Muhammad. And the only way to understand the prophet Muhammad is to understand 7th century Arabia, for that was the context in which he rose and in which he tried to speak into and develop his message. And so this evening we're going to begin by treating the historical question. What do we know about Muhammad? And then after that we're going to turn to the religious cultural question. What do Muslims view or think of Muhammad? Now, but first, and to set the scene, we really need to pause to consider pre-Islamic Arabia. And I'm going to ask Doug just to pop up a map here so we can orient ourselves. And Doug will point out Mecca and Medina. That'll be their area of focus. So Arabia before Muhammad and the rise of Islam. Dominated by deserts and steppe areas, Arabia's 1 million miles was dotted with oasis towns and cities. It was home to numerous Bedouin tribes pursuing a pastoral and nomadic lifestyle. Among the more prominent of the cities was Mecca, a centre of trade and commerce, and Yathrib, an important agricultural settlement. The principal sources of livelihood were herding, agriculture, trade, and raiding. The object of raiding was to capture livestock from enemy Bedouin tribes, and ultimately, by doing this, to weaken and absorb other tribes by reducing them to a dependent status. Now, for the most part, religion and society reflected the tribal realities of the Arabian Peninsula. Gods and goddesses served as protectors of individual tribes, and their spirits were often associated with our special places or sacred objects like trees, springs, wells, and stones. Some sites developed as the centres of cultic worship and pilgrimage. Interestingly, while various tribal deities served as the objects of worship, for many of these peoples, behind these deities was a shared belief in Al-Ilah, the one supreme God. By the late 6th century, it was Mecca that had achieved considerable status and functioned as the principal cultic centre. Many pilgrims were attracted to the shrine of a black meteorite and to the regularly held religious and cultural festivities held there. At the heart of the city of Mecca was, and still is today, the Kaaba, which at the time of Muhammad was a simple, nearly cubed-shaped structure made of dark stone. In one of its corners sat the black meteorite. Later Islamic tradition would hold that the Kaaba was built by Abraham and Ishmael at the behest of God, and that the meteorite was brought by an angel and placed in the Kaaba. At the time of Muhammad's birth, however, the Kaaba served as a central shrine. It housed 360 idols representing the local tribal deities of the area. And the cult of the Kaaba revolved around a principal deity called Allah, whose three daughters, Alat, Al-Uzza, and Mana, also figured in local deity and local practice. The Quraysh tribe had become the ruling tribe in the city and exercised authority over the Kaaba and also control over the city's affairs. The Kaaba and Meccan cult aside, into the 6th and 7th centuries were also coming ideas from Greek mythology, from Persian Zoroastrianism and Manichaeism, from Judaism and also from Christianity. However, without an Arabic Bible, there was no translation into the Arabic languages, few amongst the Arabic-speaking people had any real understanding of the stories of the Bible or of Christianity. Further, while large Christian communities existed in Abyssinia, what we know today as Ethiopia, and also in Syria, it seems that there were few Christians in and around Mecca and central Arabia. Politically, the Byzantine Empire was the major power in the area, and it competed with the Persian Sassanid Empire for control of the Middle East. There was no one dominant power in Arabia at this time, however. Rather, there were various warrior monarchs who were recruited to side with these larger powers. So no central authority ruled over the Arabs. No binding law or authority existed above that of the local tribe. That's the background, that's the environment into which Muhammad now arises. So we turn to answer the question, what do we know of the life of the Prophet Muhammad? History and legend and Muslim belief portray Muhammad as a remarkable man and prophet, and certainly Islam cannot be understood without duly considering his role, important not only for the inception of Islam as a world religion, but also for shaping and developing Islamic theology and culture from the 7th century through until today. The Prophet Muhammad warrants a very close study, and it's because of his great significance that I've chosen to start this series of lectures with a consideration of his life and ministry. Now, for convenience sake, I want to treat Muhammad's life and ministry in chronological sequence, and under 6 headings, I will try and encapsulate the basic facts, events, and influences that are necessary to understand Muhammad as Islam's holy prophet. And so we begin, first of all, with the birth and youth of Muhammad. When it comes to the birth and early life of Muhammad, we actually have very little reliable historical information. What we do know, however, is that Muhammad ibn Abdullah, the future prophet of Islam, was born in the commercially important city of Mecca around 570 AD. They're born into the Hashim family of the powerful tribe of Quraysh, yet the wealth and the prestige that Muhammad's family members had acquired through their being the caretakers and the guardians of Mecca's religious sanctuary, the Kaaba, had waned. Their power and influence was considerably diminished. In contrast to the exciting and blessed legends that surround Muhammad's birth, legends such as a host of angels attending his birth, as he's being born clean, circumcised, and with his umbilical cord already cut by the divine hand, or even his first act as a newborn being to take a handful of earth to gaze up into the heavens and proclaim, Allahu Akbar, God is great. In reality, tragedy was his lot. His father died before he was even born. In 576, when just 6 years of old, 6 years of age, his mother, Amina, also died. In 578, when just 8 years old, Muhammad's influential guardian and grandfather, Abd al-Muttalib, also died. And so from this time on, Muhammad was placed under the care of his loving paternal uncle, Abu Talib. Although Muhammad had been born into a household of privilege, a household of means, yet it seems that his uncle, Abu Talib, was somewhat poverty-stricken. This meant that although he was just a youth, yet Muhammad had to earn his own livelihood by serving as a shepherd and as a trader. And from about 582, and in relation to a business trip that Muhammad took with his uncle's caravan, there comes an important incident that is often recounted by biographers of the Holy Prophet. According to Islamic tradition, it was in this journey, while travelling through Syria with his uncle's caravan, that a Syrian monk by the name of Bukhara recognized the young Muhammad as the coming final prophet who had been prophesied in all of the great scriptures. Beyond these considerations and traditions, however, little more is actually known for sure. From all accounts, it appears that the Muhammad, though orphaned, lived a relatively normal life and grew up as other Meccan children would have. According to Islamic tradition, the chief difference between Muhammad and others of this time was that he had no participation in the pagan activities and idolatry that characterized life in Mecca. He was known to be sincere, trustworthy, and honest, apparently being called Al-Amin, the faithful one, even before he was ever called to be a prophet, the messenger of Allah. So this brings us to the marriage and adult life of Muhammad. In 595, after conducting a successful caravan trade to Syria for a wealthy widow named Khadija, Khadija then proposed marriage. Muhammad, now 25 years of age, accepted her proposal. And though Khadija was 15 years his senior, yet their marriage was a deeply satisfying one for them both. We see this, at least from one side, by the fact that Muhammad did not marry any other woman while Khadija was still alive, neither availing himself of slave girls nor the temporary marriage customs permitted at the time. Aside from the fact that Muhammad's respect constantly grew amongst the people, it seems almost nothing is known about this stage of Muhammad's life. So we know he was married, we know he continued on as a trader. Various traditions recount the fact that Khadija bore Muhammad 7 children, 4 sons and 3 daughters, and yet only one, a daughter, survived them both, Fatima. What is speculated, however, about this time is that it was most likely during this time that Muhammad grew even more disenchanted with the paganism and idolatry of Meccan society. In accordance with the custom, of pious individuals, Muhammad began the practice of devoting a period each year to retreat and worship and asceticism and prayer. Some say that he would spend a whole month in a cave at Mount Hira, 2 miles north of the city of Mecca. There he would meditate in peace and solitude, living on quite sparse rations. The summons to prophecy and the response to Muhammad's preaching. After many years of continuing to meditate in solitude, finally in the year 610, and at 40 years of age, Muhammad received the first of many revelations from Allah on the night that Muslims call the Night of Power and Excellence, and while in a state of inner reflection, a heavenly intermediary, later identified by tradition as the angel Gabriel, commanded Muhammad, "Iqra, read or recite." Frightened and with a trembling voice, Muhammad responded by saying that he didn't know what to recite. Twice the angel repeated the command, and each time a frightened and bewildered Muhammad pleaded that he didn't know what to say. Finally, the words came to him. They're contained in the Quran in Surah 96. "Recite, in the name of your Lord and Cherisher, who created man out of a clot of congealed blood. Proclaim, and your Lord is most bountiful. He who taught the use of the pen, taught man that which he did not know." Though Muhammad would go on to receive divine revelations for a period of 22 years, yet at first Muhammad was deathly afraid. He was uncertain as to the source of the revelation he received. He himself thought that a jinn, an evil spirit, might have possessed him or beguiled him. Despondent and confused, Muhammad resolved to kill himself, but was stopped when he again heard the voice say, "O Muhammad, you are the messenger of Allah, and I am Gabriel." When Muhammad returned to Khadija and relayed what had happened, she proved to be a great source of comfort and encouragement. She covered him with blankets as he shivered with fear. And after seeking the counsel of her cousin, who was a Christian, incidentally, Warika ibn Nafal, she assured Muhammad that the source of his revelation was the same as that of Moses, and that he too would become a prophet to his nation. It has been said that up to 3 years elapsed since this initial revelation and the next, but the silence did not continue. During the interval, however, Muhammad was said to have sunk into a deep despair, feeling forsaken by God, alone. The silence was broken in 613 when Muhammad received another message from the angel, beginning with a reassurance and then a command related to his mission. From the Quran, Surah 93, "By the glorious morning light, and by the night when it is still, your guardian Lord has not forsaken you, nor is he displeased. And verily the hereafter will be better for you than the present. And soon will your guardian Lord give you wherewith you shall be well pleased. Did he not find you an orphan and give you shelter and care? And he found you wandering, and he gave you guidance, and he found you in need, and he made you independent. Therefore do not treat the orphan with harshness, nor repulse the petitioner unheard, but the bounty of your Lord rehearse and proclaim." Muhammad began his ministry by preaching his mission, at first amongst his family and friends in secret, and then publicly in Mecca. The faith that he preached he called Islam, the word means submission or submitted one, and claimed that he was merely a warner to his people. His basic message consisted of belief in one sovereign God, of a great final judgment that included a bodily resurrection from the dead, and also the practice of charity to the poor and the orphans. Among his first converts were his wife Khadija, his cousin and son-in-law Ali, his adopted son Zayd, and his lifelong companion and eventual successor Abu Bakr. Now, even though Muhammad was attracting only a small group of followers, most of whom were young and who had no social standing, still the great majority of the powerful Meccan leadership opposed the self-proclaimed prophet. By 616, opposition to Muhammad's preaching had grown from indifference to hostility, and several factors were involved in the dynamics of this antagonistic relationship. On a religious level, the Meccans resisted Muhammad's doctrine of God's oneness, since it flew in the face of their practice of idolatry and their belief in many gods and a variety of idols. They also rejected his doctrine of individual resurrection, considering it ridiculous. On an economic level, Muhammad's preaching on the oneness of God and on judgment impacted negatively upon the caravan and pilgrimage trade to Mecca. The prophet's disturbing of what was a lucrative trade could not be tolerated. On the social level, the Meccans despised and feared his attacking of what to them was an inherited way of life. And on a personal level, it seems that they were both suspicious of his being a common man, who upon his own say-so had set himself up as a prophet, possessing authority over others, and of course, they were concerned at the prospect of a rival leader. All of these factors combined to produce a new wave of persecution against Muhammad and his early followers. Given the benefit of his uncle Abu Talib's protection, however, it seemed that Muhammad was verbally abused and mocked, but did not suffer any of the physical consequences that some of his followers did. Nonetheless, Muhammad was very much a hunted man. At one stage in Mecca, the council proposed a ban, a boycott of trade, of converse, and of marriage, not just with Muhammad, but with all of his tribe, the tribe of Hashim. So they were trying everything they could to try and settle this guy down and to minimize his impact. Nonetheless, as tension continued to increase, it became obvious to Muhammad that a new base of operation was necessary in order for his mission to succeed. Indeed, at one time, Muhammad even encouraged a number of his followers to seek refuge under the Christian king of Abyssinia. And in 619, when both his faithful wife Khadija and his uncle, his protector but not a believer, died, Muhammad knew that his personal safety was no longer assured. To make matters worse, it seemed that news of a fantastic mystical experience that Muhammad claimed to have had only gave his enemies more ammunition to fire at him. Known in Islamic tradition as the night journey, it is said that during the time of this turmoil, Muhammad was miraculously transported from Mecca to Jerusalem, then through the heavens where he visited with all the previous prophets, including Jesus, Moses, and Abraham, and then on into the presence of God, where he directly received the procedures for the Islamic practice of five daily prayers. Not only did Meccan opposition rally, but there were also some faithful Muslims who now began to doubt the truthfulness of their prophet. Muhammad's situation was bleak in Mecca, and none of the neighbouring Arab towns that he looked to for support obliged him. And it wasn't until the summer of 621 that relief finally came in the form of a delegation of leaders from the city of Yathrib. About a dozen men from Yathrib, who were participating in the annual pilgrimage to Mecca, sought Muhammad out and secretly confessed Islam before him. At the pilgrimage in the following year, a party of 75 people from Yathrib came to Muhammad, embracing the faith of Islam and inviting the Prophet to come to their city, where they would pledge allegiance to him and where they promised to protect the Prophet and his followers as they would their own families. This brings us to the Hijra. Shortly after this welcoming invitation, Muhammad ordered his followers to make their way to Yathrib, a city about 200 miles north of Mecca. The Muslims slipped away in small groups, and about 150 emigrated. When the Meccan leaders were informed about the Muslim migration, they plotted to kill Muhammad before he could leave for Yathrib and rejoin his followers there. On the night of the planned assassination, however, Muhammad and his companion Abu Bakr successfully escaped Mecca, and on September 24, 622, reached Yathrib safely. So far as Muslims speak of the origin or founding of Islam, this journey, known as the Hijra, meaning emigration or flight, was a monumental turning point in Islam's development, marking the creation of the first Islamic community, the commencement of the Muslim calendar, and dividing the Quran into its Meccan and Medinan surahs. The Hijra, more than the Prophet's birth or the onset of his receiving revelation, is the watershed of Islamic history. It is here that Muhammad's prophethood culminates and his rulership begins. Muhammad at Medina and the creation of an Islamic community. In contrast to the Meccans, Muhammad was well received in Yathrib. Yathrib, by the way, soon changed its name to Madinat and Nabi, the city of the Prophet, or simply Medina. From what we know, it seems that several factors played into this reception. From a religious perspective, it seems that the residents of Medina were more inclined toward monotheism due to the influence of a well-established group of Jewish people in the area. Islamic tradition also tells us of a report that the Jewish people talked about, of their coming from the desert, a prophet, a great and final prophet. The other factor that played into this was a social and political one. It seems this prosperous agricultural city had been dragged into a series of bloody feuds amongst its leading tribes and families, and it was hoped that Muhammad would act as an arbiter among the opposing parties, bringing the city back into a period of settledness, stability, and peace. Both of these realities served Muhammad well. Whereas in Mecca he was for the most part a purely religious figure, now in Medina he almost immediately became an able diplomat and politician as well as religious leader. Now he could exhort his audience by Quranic revelation and enforce his ideals through his newly gained civil power. From 622 to 629, Muhammad really had two primary tasks. The first consisted of consolidating the various Arabic clans, particularly the two Muslim parties of the Muhajirun, being the Meccan Muslims who emigrated with him, and the Ansar, the native Medinans who had embraced Islam, as well as the more influential Jewish tribes, into one unified front. Remarkably successful in unifying these various factions, Medina was established as a city-state, and Muhammad drew up a new constitution for the city, under which every group was obligated to coexist peacefully and to support each other against foreign attack. Muhammad's overall success, however, was somewhat offset by his failure to completely win the support of the entire Jewish tribes. With Muhammad considering himself to be merely a continuator of the great prophetic traditions of Christianity and Judaism, the prophet made some important concessions in his efforts to win the Jews. In conformity with Jewish practice, Muhammad instructed his followers to face Jerusalem and to pray in that direction. He also adopted the Jewish Day of Atonement as a festival. However, on the basis of discrepancies between Quranic revelation and their own scriptures, the Jews rejected Muhammad's prophetship and his claims. Not only did this change Muhammad's policy toward the Jews, but eventually he altered the prayer direction from Jerusalem back toward the shrine at Mecca, and he changed the time of fasting from the Day of Atonement to the month of Ramadan. Beyond this, the rejection of the Jews led Muhammad to the conviction that the Jews had tampered with the revelation in their scripture. He concluded that only the version revealed to him contained the true and real text of the biblical stories, that his faith was the pure faith of Abraham, and that pure monotheism, represented for the first time by Abraham, but corrupted by the Jews and by the Christians, had only now come alive again in Islam. Interestingly, it was also at this time that Quranic pronouncements became more severe in their criticism of the Jews, and that the Quranic emphasis on Abraham as the central figure in Islam became noticeable. In addition to this project of unifying the tribes, a second serious challenge that Muhammad faced was what to do about Mecca's rejection of Islam and the fact that the divine word could not be allowed to fail, and so ensured the post-Hijra campaign of military combat. The prophet's sanctioning of raids and the series of battles that marked the years 622 through 629 ought not to be seen solely as a case of mere opportunism or a financial gain, nor of his merely having to find a livelihood for those Meccans who emigrated with him. Rather, it was in these battles that Muhammad was challenging and continuing to challenge Quraishi power and the custodianship of an idolatrous and pagan faith. Thus, in March 624, and after the success of an earlier raid in January, in which Muslims spilled Quraishi blood for the first time, Muhammad himself led his Muslim forces against an assembled Muslim army at a place called Baida. Though outnumbered 3-1, Muhammad's superior military strategy and the zeal of his followers overpowered the overconfident Meccans. While the Muslims lost 14 men in this engagement, and the Meccan force was dealt a far more serious blow, losing 45 men and having 70 more taken captive, this great victory was interpreted by Muhammad as a sign of God's vindication of his prophethood. Muhammad and his followers were buoyed by Quranic revelation informing them that Allah himself and his angels had fought on their side. Not surprisingly, Muhammad's prestige continued to grow after this battle at Badr. The Meccans, well aware of their humbling defeat, once again prepared themselves for another confrontation with Muslim forces. So in 625, exactly 1 year later, the Meccans met again at Mount Uhud. Again, Muhammad's supporters were outnumbered 3-1, this time with the Meccans amassing 3,000 against the Muslims' 1,000. Again, the battle began to move in favour of the Muslims, despite the numerical superiority of the Meccans. But this time around, the failure of a group of Muslim archers to maintain their position created an opportunity for the Meccan army to regroup and to counterattack by coming behind the Muslim armies. Muslims now started to run in all directions, and confusion, fueled by the rumour that the enemy had killed the Prophet, turned what was a sure victory into a sound defeat. Although 70 Muslims died and Muhammad himself was injured, yet he and the bulk of his force were eventually able to withdraw to a secure position and return to Medina, while the Meccans, rejoicing in their victory, returned home. Muhammad's defeat struck a deep psychological blow to his prestige in the region. In some quarters, Muhammad's opponents, local Medinians, some local Jewish antagonists, made no secret of their delight in the Prophet's misfortunes. Despite these setbacks, however, Muhammad continued in his effort to strengthen his position. He led more attacks on neighbouring tribes so as to extend his own alliances and prevent others from joining with the Meccans. Realising now that they needed to crush Muhammad's growing power once and for all, in 627 the Meccans, led by Abu Sufyan, led a great Arab confederacy of over 10,000 men against the Muslims at Medina. This time around, Muhammad decided to remain within the city, and based upon the advice of Salman al-Farsi, a Persian disciple, Muhammad dug a ditch in front of the unprotected parts of the city. The Meccans surrounded the city and camped there for 2 weeks, but afterwards lost their determination and went home. Apart from their repeated failures to cross the ditch, it seems that their coalition was also broken up by Muhammad's secret negotiations with various tribes and by unfavourable weather conditions. Muhammad's position was strengthened after the silent victory, and for the next 2 years was quickly on the rise. He led a number of successful campaigns that brought about the greater financial gain of his community. This, as well as his sending out representatives to teach the Quran and the duties and rituals of Islam, brought many more people into the fold of Islam and strengthened its unity. Conversely, while Medina was increasing, the military and economic strength of Mecca was in rapid decline. To make matters worse, several of the city's leading men defected and joined Muhammad's ranks. And in March 628, the Meccans signed a peace treaty with Muhammad. Significantly, this treaty allowed the Muslims to make pilgrimage to Mecca, a factor that suggests that Muhammad was no longer to be thought of as a renegade, as a rebellious fugitive, but rather as an opponent of equal rank. In 629, when Muhammad had established control over the Hejaz, Central Arabia, he led a pilgrimage to Mecca, to the town of his birth. This brings us to the conquest of Mecca and the final days of Muhammad. An attack by Meccan allies on Muhammad's Muslims about a year after the peace treaty had been struck caused the treaty to be nullified. Taking full advantage of this, Muhammad, now with an army of over 10,000 men, marched on the city of Mecca in January 630. Upon entering the streets of the city and encountering little to no opposition, Muhammad almost immediately headed for the Kaaba to cleanse it of its idols. Touching the black meteorite with his stick and proclaiming, "Allahu Akbar, God is greater. He ordered all the idols to be thrown down and called upon the pagan Koresh to pay homage to him. This they did, filing past him. Most amazingly of all, and with only few exceptions, Muhammad then promised a general pardon to all in Mecca. He even gave each one of the prominent Meccans, including Abu Sayyim, generous gifts and rewards for their surrender. In this act, Muhammad not only conquered his lifelong enemies, but also won their respect and admiration, although doubtless many were pleased when the Prophet chose to return to Medina and not reside in Mecca. After Mecca had surrendered to Muhammad, a large number of tribes in the Arabian Peninsula followed suit and professed their allegiance to the Prophet. So many tribes sent delegations to strike terms with Muhammad that Muslim history remembers this as the year of deputation. Still others submitted after being defeated by the Prophet's armies. As a general rule, Muhammad obligated heathen tribes to denounce paganism and profess Islam, whereas Christians and Jews could practice their own faith if they paid him tributes and taxes. In March 632, 10 years after his emigration from Mecca to Medina, Muhammad personally led the Islamic pilgrimage to Mecca and delivered what was to become his farewell sermon in front of tens of thousands of his followers. In June 632, Muhammad suddenly fell ill of a fever and died. According to Islamic tradition, Muhammad whispered the words, "O Allah, with the compassionate on high," and took his last breath. He was 63 years old and died a peaceful and natural death. Outside the mosque in Medina, where the gathering crowd could not believe the Prophet had died, Abu Bakr, Muhammad's lifelong companion, calmly ascended the steps of the Prophet's mosque and addressed the crowd. "Whoever worshipped Muhammad, know that Muhammad is dead. But whoever worshipped Allah, know that Allah is alive." He then added from the words of the Quran and Surah 3, "Muhammad is no more than a messenger. Many were the messengers that passed away before him. If he died or was slain, will you then turn back your heels? If any did turn back on his heels, not the least harm will be done to Allah. But Allah, on the other hand, will swiftly reward those who serve him with gratitude." By the time of Muhammad's death, an unprecedented political unity had been achieved in Arabia. As prophet, religious leader, reformer, state builder, and in the end, virtual master of all of Arabia, Muhammad had created both a community in which the laws of daily human behavior were prescribed by Allah, and a solidarity that opened the way for Islam's incredible conquests and growth. Having looked at Muhammad from a predominantly historical perspective, we now need to round out our lecture by briefly addressing the cultural religious point of view. Like all other religious figures of significance, we need to step beyond history and consider the place that Muhammad holds in the living faith of millions of his followers today. Initially, I suggested we could get at this by asking the question, how do Muslims view Muhammad? Obviously, this is a huge area, one worthy of a whole lecture in itself. But on this occasion, let me just summarize by offering the four following points. First, Muslims view Muhammad as Islam's reformer, not as its founder. Though obviously understood to be a prophet sent from Allah, yet Muslims do not view Muhammad as the founder of Islam. Neither do Muslims believe that Muhammad started a new religion. Rather, the prophet is acknowledged to have come as a religious reformer who called people back to the one true God and to a way that most of his contemporaries has either forgotten or deviated from. Around the world, Muslims maintain that Muhammad conveyed the same message as all the other great prophets of God, including Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. And where Jewish and Christian communities had distorted God's original revelation to Moses and then later to Jesus, Muhammad brought reformation. The message and ministry of Muhammad was the call to once again to surrender or submit to Allah and the implementation of his will as revealed in its final form. As the last or the seal of the prophets, Muhammad brought forth no new faith, but rather the restoration of the true faith, a process that required him to reform an ignorant and deviant society, turning them away from the path of unbelief and back to the straight path, or law of God. Appreciating this helps us to understand why the message Muhammad proclaims is not named after him, and also why Muslims are not called Muhammadans, an insulting term that seems to have emerged during the Crusades. Secondly, Muslims look to and emulate Muhammad as the model Muslim. From the beginning, Muhammad's remarkable character and personality inspired uncommon devotion and commitment amongst Muslims. And Muslims have revered him even from the earliest times. With his words and actions remembered and recounted, both during his own lifetime and throughout the following centuries, Muhammad has always served as the ideal or model Muslim who set forth all the patterns that Muslims are to emulate. Encouraged by the Quranic injunction found in Surah 33, "You have indeed the messenger of Allah, a beautiful pattern of conduct for any whose hope is in Allah and the final day." The reports of Muhammad's sayings and actions were tirelessly collected by subsequent generations of Muslims and employed to inspire the individual believer, within the individual believer, a detailed conformity to Muhammad in even the most ordinary details. Today, Muslims living in every culture look to Muhammad's example for guidance in all aspects of life. Whether the issue is how to treat your friends or your enemies, what to eat and drink, how to make love or war, guidance for personal hygiene, dress, treatment of wives, diplomacy or whatever, Muhammad's sayings and deeds function normatively for Muslims. As a definitive Muslim, Muhammad is esteemed and emulated not only by the individual Muslim, but also by the Islamic community or state. Islamic law and social government alike look to and are based upon the sayings and practices of Muhammad. Thirdly, many Muslims relate to Muhammad devotionally, seeing in him more than a prophet. No sincere Muslim will tolerate the disparaging of Muhammad, not just because of the prophet's status within Islam, but also because of a deeply wrought devotion within themselves. Speaking as one of the great Muslim thinkers of the 20th century, Iqbal summed up the feelings of Muslims when he said, "Love of the Prophet runs like blood in the veins of his community." Before this, Zayn Bader Arabi wrote, "100,000 graces, blessings and perfect salutations be upon the soul of the leader of lovers and the foremost of all mystics, the Prophet Muhammad. If he had not existed, who would have existed? He was such a prophet that God had ordained for him an abode without roof in the very proximity of himself, as well as 100,000 miracles and 100,000 signs of intimacy completely unknown to any angel, prophet or saint. In Muhammad, he pitched the tent of his glory in the desert of the existence of this world." This kind of ardent devotion continues to be widespread amongst Muslims generally. Beyond his prophethood, many Muslims look to Muhammad as an intercessor before God. They assign him noble names, often the exact same names of Allah. Some hold to the doctrine of the light of Muhammad, a tradition which teaches that God first created the light of Muhammad and then from that light later proceeded to make the rest of creation. Amongst the Sufi, mystic-oriented Muslims, there is a tendency to receive and celebrate Muhammad as the human axis of divine grace. Muhammad is here viewed as a kind of conduit through which divine love and forgiveness may be experienced and through which the human lover may cherish the divine. He is spoken of as the perfection of humanity, not just in a moral sense, but also in a metaphysical sense, as a divine idea imminent in the entire creation. He is also viewed as an animating principle of the whole world. That a deep devotion to Muhammad is such a central element in Islam, and that for many Muslims Muhammad is viewed as more than a prophet and is an object of devotion possessing a mediatorial significance, I often wonder how Muslims can be so quick to write off Christian belief about Jesus as the Word made flesh, when a compatible notion and devotion seemed to exist within our own tradition. Finally, Muslims see Muhammad as an honoured man, but not as divine. A Muslim's devotion to and respect for Muhammad notwithstanding, it is crucial to point out that Islamic theology does not consider Muhammad divine. According to the Quran and Orthodox Islam, Muhammad was a human being whom God chose to be the final messenger of mankind. Because of their strict monotheism, Muslims are not embarrassed about Muhammad's humanity in the least. Further, because Muslims posit prophethood as the height of God's activity in the world and understand that God closed the office of prophet with Muhammad, his status is not only undiminished, but actually exalted. He is seen as the recipient of the greatest honour that God could bestow upon any human being in the world. Thus, while Muslims do not worship Muhammad, yet they do revere him as the last and greatest of all the prophets, as the one most favoured of mankind. Well, with both the historical and cultural religious discussion over, I hear the silent question, well, what do you think of Muhammad? In all honesty, and to conclude, I find myself impressed by Muhammad's strong leadership and fascinated by the devotion that he attracted then and now. I am thankful for his belief in one God, and I am awed by the way in which he united and improved the conditions for so many in the Arab world. But I do not believe Muhammad was a prophet. With respect, I do not believe he was the messenger sent from God. As a Christian, I neither see him mentioned or prophesied to come in the Old Testament, nor in the New Testament, where to the contrary, God speaks to us through Jesus as the final revelation of himself. Any questions, any discussion? This is always the fun part. Grimes. Yeah, that's a great question. How do Christians and Muslims get together around a table and begin to dialogue and talk to each other? How? Well, basically, and primarily I think by, we can sit down and talk by respecting each other's differences. We don't have to begin by denying them or by glossing over them, as has been so often the case. So we begin by respecting and acknowledging there are real differences. Also, as a Christian, because this is the perspective I'm coming from, I can sit down with a Muslim and have sat down with many Muslims because I believe that Muslim, like me, is made in the image of God and he's valuable. He's another human being who I can talk with rationally, reasonably, politely, gently. So, I mean, that's the how. The other part of that is, content-wise, which is more trickier, I think there is some common ground. I use that term kind of very loosely because once you dig down, the commonality decreases very quickly. But when you read the Quran, when you read the prophetic traditions of Hadith, when you read the biographies of Muhammad, it's amazing how many parallel themes and issues and doctrines there are that we can talk about. One example that I found myself talking about a lot with Muslims was Muslim view of the end times. Seems to me that Muslim eschatology is basically straight out of the New Testament. And Muslims, of course, would be horrified at hearing me say that, but their doctrine of final judgment, their doctrine of bodily resurrection, their doctrine of there being rewards and punishments, of there being a book of life, of there being a final eternal destination, either heaven, paradise, or hell, all of these things are endemic to Islamic theology, and they're, of course, very much a part of Christian theology. So there's something we can talk about straight away. I think we can also talk about the concept of prophethood. I mean, Muslims, of course, offer Muhammad as the final prophet. We offer Jesus. And so we have discussion about the nature of prophecy. What does it mean to be a prophet? What are the qualifications? What are the criteria to be a biblical prophet? And that's not a word that's strange necessarily to Muslims, because Muslims accept the biblical data and the biblical prophets and the biblical criteria. So without wanting to suggest that it's easy, there is actually a great deal that we can talk about, And we, as long as we can respect one another and treat the differences honestly, it's actually not difficult to sit down and talk. And Muslims, perhaps more so than Hindus or Buddhists, are more ready to sit down and talk. They're very open to dialoguing with Christians. There are actually quite a number of models, and there are good examples of Christians and Muslims talking to each other in this country as well. For those who are students here or visiting, up in the bookshelf, there's a top shelf, middle row there, is a book called Christians and Muslims at the Table. And that book offers one example of how we can sit down and talk and what the content of our talking should be. So that's a resource for later. Yes, Ben. I'll answer the second question first. What can we attribute Muhammad's rise to? Is it connected with his position in his tribe? The Quraysh had been a powerful tribe in Mecca for centuries. The Quraysh tribe were the guardians and the custodians of the Kaaba. One of the clans of that tribe is the Hashim, and Muhammad was born into that clan as a part of that tribe. So early on, before these claims of being a prophet, I think there was probably a lot of privilege extended to him because of his connection. Later, it was the Quraysh who really persecuted Muhammad. And the Quraysh issued, as I mentioned, an edict or a ban that punished the whole Hashim tribe because of the things Muhammad was teaching. The leaders of Mecca went to the Hashim leaders and said, listen, you've got to shut this guy down. And if you're not going to do it, then we're going to treat you all the same. And they wouldn't do it. A very strong code of tribal loyalty in Arabic culture, and they refused to ostracize one of their own. So the Quraysh ostracized that clan, that tribe. So afterwards, when Muhammad was in Mecca, I don't think there was a great deal of power, a great deal of prestige given to him because of that political connection anymore. Perhaps, and this is my speculation, perhaps one of the reasons Muhammad was so keen to make Mecca his base and to again have access to the Kaaba had to do with the fact that he was a Qurayshi, that he was a member of the Hashim, and that was significant for him personally. But I think it was more his charisma, more his leadership abilities, more his character than his connections that made him the leader that he was. The second question, the establishment of the Quran as a text, that's a huge... I'm going to actually talk about the Quran next lecture sometime in March. Briefly, the Islamic answer is that the Quran has always been around. It's been preserved in heaven on a table. And it was revealed to Muhammad, peace, Poe peace. And whenever Muhammad spoke these surahs, these Quranic verses, there were those around him who quickly wrote them down. And the hadith, the prophetic traditions talk about the Quran being recorded straight away on stones and on pieces of bark and on the back of sticks and all kinds of things. In actual fact, it seems much more likely that it wasn't until the reign of Uthman, quite some years later, 50, 60 years later, that the Quran was settled as a text. That would put it much, when was Muhammad, 570, 630? So not until the middle of the 8th century, something like that. Again, it's debated. There seems to have been some written language, but it does not seem to have been particularly strong. Like early Judaism, it was a very strong oral culture, and so much more was handed down orally than was ever written or recorded. Muslims and Arabic scholars really defend that there was a developed language, that there was early records. But we're still kind of to see them. The evidence is really questionable. It seems that it was because of the Quran that the Arabic language developed, in a sense, because there was a need to record it and write it down and stabilise it as a text. So, I mean, that's not a real helpful or clear answer, but it seems that... Yeah. Akin to that, yes. In the back row. Yeah, the satanic verses. Very early on, around 616, when Muhammad began to preach very publicly and began to encounter the opposition of the Meccan leaders, one of the ways that he attempted to win them to Islam was to permit the worship of some of the favourite local deities. The three daughters of Al-Illah was recognized as the one supreme god. But afterwards, Muhammad said that Satan put those words in his mouth. That was wrong, not what he meant to say. Allah does not compromise. There is one God only, and no one should worship these idols. And so the Quran, the surah, I believe surah 90:53, now has been amended to read something else. But that's the what's known in early tradition as the satanic verses. And we only know about it because early Arabic tradition recorded it. Muslim scholars today, Muslim apologists, deny that. They would say that the satanic verses, that whole episode, is a mistake. It's not true. It's a fabrication by Christians and Jews. But the only way we know about it is because of early records that come from Arabia. So that's the satanic verses, so-called. Erica? Yeah, that's a good question. Why did people follow Muhammad? First of all, I think, from what we've even talked about tonight, one, he had a very charismatic personality. Two, he was a very strong and a very effective leader, both politically, militarily, and obviously religiously. He was also... I think when he began to preach and talk about Islam, he also was preaching a message that the Arab world was ready to hear. What was going on in 6th, 7th century Central Arabia was a move away from the polytheism of tribes to a kind of monotheism. It's not an evolutionary religion, but there was at the same time this general move. And so they talked about there being this figure, Al-Illah, behind all these deities. And so Muhammad comes and speaks about Allah. So I think there's an audience ready to hear. Not only that, the influences coming into Central Arabia through Judaism and through early Christian missionaries and through some of the small Christian enclaves in Syria and in Ethiopia. He preached a message that included all that had gone before. So it wasn't something de novo, it wasn't something new and out of the blue. He was saying, yes, this is all true and it's good and I'm standing on their shoulders. So I think that was another reason why he was heard. When it comes to miracles, the Quran, not so much the Quran, but the Hadith, the traditions, actually attribute a number of miracles to Muhammad. Muhammad himself and Islamic theology points to the Quran as Allah's main miracle. How do you know that how do you know that Muhammad was a prophet? Because you have the Quran. The Quran is the word of God and says he's a prophet. So it's very circular, but before we jump up and down, we have to think carefully about how we as Christians think about the Bible and prophets there. But this is a very directly circular argument. Some of the miracles that surround Muhammad, the ones I talked about briefly at his birth, about there being a host of angels surrounding him, pronouncing his birth. There's an early, kind of a mid to early tradition that says Muhammad's parents were immaculately conceived, kind of thing. Something like Jesus and Mary, that his parents were kept from all sin so that the prophet could come into the world and speak truth and without error. There's also a story I didn't talk about was the fact that very early on, that an angel was to come from heaven and opened up the Prophet Muhammad's chest, took out his heart, cleansed it, and put it back in and closed him up. And then we had the story about the Syrian monk, Bahrain, who allegedly kind of encountered Muhammad and identified him very early on as a great prophet, one who would lead his nation. It's interesting, in the hadith, he asked the question, how did Bahrain identify Muhammad as a prophet? He says that between the prophet's shoulder blades was a lump, like a large mole, and that distinguished him as the prophet of Allah who was to come. And then the night journey where Allah is taken to Jerusalem and heaven. And then there are all kinds, then you get into miracles that really parallel Jesus, healings and making food appear. And so within Islam, within the Islamic worldview, Muhammad certainly is a supernatural prophet, the way Jesus is. So there's some of the reasons I think that Muslims have been compelled to follow him. Isaac, then we'll get over here then. Yeah, can Muslims study the Bible? Yes. And their Quran says they can, and they ought, and they should. And the Quran calls Christians and Jews the people of the book. We're honoured and we're set apart from all other religious viewpoints and philosophies as being worthy of taking note. In recent years, various conservative Muslim groups have banned and have instructed and discouraged people from reading the Bible lest they be converted. But that's, I still think, a minority. Many Muslims around the world do read the Bible, and they consider it a part of their spiritual canon. And I think when you encounter a Muslim who's suspicious of the Bible, we should encourage them to go to the Quran and to consider what the Quran says about the stories and figures of the Bible. What you do need to bear in mind, and this is kind of the second part of your question, how do we talk to them about the Bible? Muslims have a very different view of our Bible. A part of the Muslim worldview is that we've distorted our Bible. That's why it says different things. Muhammad got it right. The Quran's got it right. We've got it wrong. The Muslims that I've met and talked with and studied with continuously tell me that they know more about my Christian faith than I do. That's their language. That's not me having a shot at them. That's how they talk to me. They, as Muslims, having received the Quran through Muhammad, know how we should understand the Bible. There's one over here first. Yeah, that's a good point. How many of the miracles attributed to Muhammad are actually contained in the Quran? The miracles, very few as such. The Quran continually presents itself as the miracle of Muhammad. So most of them are in prophetic tradition. But it's important to recognize that in Islam and in the Muslim worldview, prophetic tradition is also inspired. Okay? The Quran is the word of God, the word of Allah, who has come through the prophet. It alone is inerrant. But the prophetic traditions, the life of Muhammad, his sayings, many of these stories, were recorded very early, and they're also classed as being inspired and therefore as authoritative. And so one of the big issues for Muslim scholars, particularly Western Muslim scholars who adapt Western ways of reasoning and doing scholarship, how in the world do you put the Quran and the Hadith together and equate them? Because there are numerous contradictions. Even, for example, the account of Muhammad's prophethood, the night of power and excellence. The Quran has four different accounts. The days of creation are figured differently in the Quran. So, yes, a lot of the miracles and things are not actually in the Quran, they're in the Hadith. But at the same time, Islamic theology makes the Hadith authoritative. How much of the history tonight that I talked about is in the Quran? Probably all the major events are there. I quoted from the Quran at least six or seven times. So the major events are there. The detail is in the Hadith, which again is considered inspired and authoritative, and it's in early 8th century biographies. That's true. The difference being that they're not considered extra-biblical. They're put right on par. The Jewish community and Roman Catholics do have their traditions, but generally they're very much distinguished from canonical scripture, whereas in Islam The two are much related, much more equitably. But otherwise, yeah. Dr. Larson. Yeah. How much did Muhammad know or hear about Christians? Some, but not enough. It seems, given the environment of 6th and 7th century Arabia, there were some Christian communities in the general vicinity, as I said, in Ethiopia or Abyssinia and Syria, where, because of the caravan and the trade routes, people were constantly bumping into Christians. There's a tradition that says that Khadija, Muhammad's first wife, actually had a Christian Ebionite background. And then Khadija's cousin, who confirmed Muhammad in his prophethood, he was a Christian, a professing Christian at the time. But there's, at the same, having said that, there's the some. The not enough part is the scriptures were not available in Arabic, and many of the Christians that were floating around and Muhammad had exposure to seemed to be kind of heretical. Most of them were Nestorian, kind of a very different understanding of the person and work of Christ. There's a whole lot of them who are Gnostic. And so there's this view of Christ as kind of one of the eons, one of the emanations from God in this kind of grand chain of being. And so that was in there. There was a group, I'm still trying to kind of get to the bottom of, there was a group who had a very high kind of Mary worship in there. And Muhammad believed that the Christian Trinity was wrong, because the Trinity was God the Father, God the Son, and Mary the Holy Mother. And so, and that's actually recorded in the Quran. And so somewhere, Muhammad was obviously exposed to some early form of Mariology. So that was floating around at the time. Later on, in Medina, being about 200 miles north of Mecca and much closer to kind of the bottom end of the Red Sea, there was kind of a lot more movement from Jerusalem coming down and from the Byzantine Empire. And so it seems that there were some early Christian movements that at least the Medinans knew about, and we can only speculate how much contact Muhammad had with them. It seems to me, by the fact that he talks quite a bit in the Quran about Jesus, in the Quran it's Isa, that there was some knowledge. But as I said, sadly not enough. Yes, David, or Sarah? Sure, it's a good question. Specific ways that Muslims believe we've misinterpreted the Bible. One, by failing to see the prophets of the Old Testament forecasting the rise of Muhammad. Muslims go to Deuteronomy 18:18, which is a prophecy about a prophet to come, and they say that's Muhammad. In the New Testament, they go to John chapters 14 and 16, passages that Christians see Jesus talking about the coming of the Holy Spirit as the Comforter, the one who will guide you into all truth. Muslims point to those passages within the New Testament as being a forecast of Muhammad. Muslims believe that Jesus did not die on the cross. He was rescued. And so we've misunderstood the whole thing there. One tradition says actually by a miracle, Allah took Jesus off the cross and put Judas up there. And it was Judas who died and Jesus went away, because no prophet can undergo shame in Islam. Muslims look at the way that we translate our Bibles, and they look at the variety of translations, and they say, here's proof. You guys can't get it right. You don't know where is the real Bible? Where is the original manuscript? They're all different. And so they point to the number of translations, and even to the fact that there's manuscripts that conflict or apparently conflict. So they point to that kind of material evidence as well. They also reach back into Old Testament history. And Muslims claim, of course, that Arabic tribes descend from Ishmael, the son of Abraham. That's never been determined historically or archaeologically. The jury's out on that. Even if it is, they go on to say that really Ishmael was the child of favour, not Isaac. And so it was Abraham and Ishmael who come to Mecca and build the Kaaba and establish the worship of Allah right there in Arabia. So there's some of the ways. And David. another really good question. What did Muhammad actually reform? What were the social or moral conditions of Arabia at the time? Muslim scholars themselves really stress that Muhammad was a great social reformer. Muslim scholars speak of their own lineage of Arabic tribes as being deviant, as being idolatrous, as being kind of up to their eyeballs in blood feuds. It's kind of almost honourable to rip your neighbour off kind of thing. So it seems that there was not a huge high moral ground amongst these tribes. I'm sure if we lived amongst the tribes, there'd be some, obviously, moral standards and things, but as a whole, it wasn't a hugely high morality. Muhammad really regulated the moral beliefs and practices of Islam. He established laws to do with every possible aspect of living in a community. It's just amazing what he does talk about. And some of the things, for example, when he went to Medina, the first opportunity he had to actually have some civil power, he sat down and he wrote a code that said that anybody living in the city, not only must they not fight one another, but they must actually band together to protect themselves from raiders or from oncoming armies. And so he really established a kind of a brotherhood there. There's a huge question over Muhammad and how many wives he had and what was going on there. We can get into that if we want, but the point in this circumstance is that even though Muhammad had a number of wives, and even though he was a polygamist, he himself established a number of laws and rules designed to protect women, and particularly wives, in that culture, and how they were to be treated. And so the Quran, for example, says that no Muslim can have more than four wives, because it's impossible to support them all properly, and to be faithful to them and maintain them. And that sounds weird, like four wives, but I mean, he was actually limiting kind of men running off and having a whole bunch of women and never seeing or looking after any of them.